Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. The creators of the podcast, Everything Sounds, produce an entire show focused on sounds you've never heard before and sharing untold stories about sounds that you've heard time and time again. In this episode, hosts Craig Shank and George Drake Jr. uncover a world of singing that's just as reliant on sight as it is on sound. I'll let Craig take it from here.
Okay. Shape note is an old tradition. It was introduced in the late 1700s and early 1800s, and the intent was to help people sight sing, which is to be able to sing just based on the notes that they see on the page. That sight singing really kept people from learning the music. They couldn't read notes.
They thought that music would be opened up to the masses if they could read the music.
So to make this easier for people who didn't know how to read them, they turned the notes into shapes.
There is a square, a triangle, a circle, and a diamond.
Here's how Ruth describes it in her paper.
I'll read the sentence that goes before it too.
Okay.
The use of shapes was meant to facilitate congregational singing by making songs easier to sight read. An experienced shape note singer quickly associates the shape of the note with its position in the scale.
So those shapes, the square, triangle, circle, and diamond, replaced the head of each note. But the music structure itself is also a little bit different.
Okay. Now you can take it away, Kate.
That's Craig's girlfriend.
Okay, in the standard 7-note musical scale, it's do. Okay, in the standard 7-note musical scale, it's do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
But in sacred harp singing, in the 4-note tradition, there's fa, sol, la, mi, fa, which makes a major scale.
Which would sound like this.
Fa, sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, fa.
Think of it less as a change in the content and more of just a change of presentation. It's like changing your font from Times New Roman to Arial or painting a door to a different color. You can still open and close that door, but it just looks different.
In shape note, fa is a triangle.
Which is like a flag, fa.
So is a circle.
Which is for the sun.
La is a square. And that leaves you with mi.
Is a diamond, which is the leading tone, so you don't see many mis.
So the shapes would be laid out like this.
Triangle, circle, square, triangle, circle, square, diamond, triangle.
But in shape note singing, they don't actually sing the names of the shapes like that. That's just to help you understand this concept.
Although people aren't singing shape note to help them read music as much anymore, what's important is that they're keeping the tradition alive. And that's actually what we'll be figuring out in today's episode. Why it stayed around for so long, and what's still keeping it around today.
Welcome to the, in sacred harp circles, known as the Lincoln's Birthday Singing. It's also a sacred harp.
When you go to a shape note sing, it may seem a little odd at first. There's no audience. The sing isn't considered a rehearsal for a bigger performance. The sing is it. That's everything. It's a gathering of people singing together. It's in a unique arrangement, too. They call it the hollow square.
The idea of arranging around a hollow square, I think, was a natural result of the way the pews were set up in country churches.
That's Ann Heider. She's a choral conductor and an active member of the Chicago Shape Note Singers.
Imagine a clock face and place big squares of pews at the 12, 3, 6, and 9 o'clock positions, all facing inward. These are the treble, alto, tenor, and bass sections. The smaller square that's left in the middle, that's the hollow square that Anne's talking about. And if somebody wants to lead a song, that's where they stand. But they don't just get up and stand in the middle. That's not how it's done.
No, it really isn't.
No, that's just poor form. It's much more organized. Let's say it's a big sing with about 20 people or so, maybe even more. Before people even take their seats, they fill out a card, which also acts as an attendance. The card asks two questions. What's your name, and would you like to lead?
You fill out a little piece of paper with your name on it, and you check yes, And that piece of paper goes to a group of two or three people who are called the arranging committee.
From there, it's the arranging committee's job to select people to lead.
One after another.
And to make sure that they choose different songs from what's already been sung that day.
The leader stands in the center of this hollow square with the rows of singers facing inward from the four sides.
They call out the number of song that they'd like to sing.
542.
Somebody, usually on the front bench of the tenor section, will sound a pitch.
All of the singers then come in with their own pitches.
And sort of tune up that chord. And then the leader beats time.
Which kind of like mimicking a karate chop or a tomahawk with your hand.
And the singers go through the song, singing the notes, calling them by their shapes, which is fa, so, la, and mi.
And once they're done singing it through with the shapes, they go ahead and sing the song.
And that's it. Then you sit down and someone else gets up to lead.
In standing in the middle, with a 360 degrees of voices coming your way, that's something pretty wild.
Sacred harp is one of the more common shape note traditions. There are sacred harp singers in just about every state in the U.S., as well as ones in Germany, Ireland, and the U.K. It's named after the book they use, which, as Ruth said, is a four-note structure. There are other four-note traditions out there, like the Nurumbega, Missouri, and Shenandoah harmony, but there are also seven-note traditions which use different shapes, but we won't go into those today. For now, we're only going to focus on the sacred harp. At the very beginning, it wasn't sacred harp. It wasn't even shape note at the time.
Even before shape notes, there was a lively tradition of itinerant singing teachers who traveled around from town to town and would set up a temporary singing school, have a week or 2 weeks of classes or lessons, and then maybe sell the locals a few copies of his song collection, and then pack up the saddlebags and on to the next town.
So these traveling teachers taught their ways of singing across the eastern seaboard. Soon after, other people started to teach it as well, and the method of learning to sing with shapes was catching on.
Along the Ohio River Valley westward and south down the Appalachian Mountain chain,
songbooks started forming, and they were filled with music that people already knew, as well as newer music by young composers who could have just learned how to read music from notes. After the War of Independence and the War of 1812,
and the United States was sort of on its feet, maybe a little shaky, but still a functioning entity,
established European musicians started coming over to get jobs, which they couldn't necessarily get back home.
And they brought with them music by composers like Haydn and Mozart and Schubert and Mendelssohn, they had the cachet of being European.
The new European music followed different rules of composition,
which were deemed scientific,
than the people in the U.S. were used to. And all of a sudden, what was then considered to be old-timey music
that had been composed by colonial composers and a lot of it transcribed into shape notes
was seen as crude and outdated. All in all, it wasn't worth performing anymore. But in the country,
and especially along the Appalachian chain,
it wasn't seen that way. It was special to them. It was what they created and what they inevitably passed on.
It was cherished and kept alive.
Shape note singing was a major part of the southern states.
Bits and pieces of East Texas.
And the western part of Virginia.
It was a thriving tradition with lots of annual events where people would come from miles around.
Where they'd gather to sing together. For many people, it was a major form of entertainment. But as time went on, shape note had to compete with the changing times. Improved travel, and soon after, the radio started displacing shape note as entertainment. It also had to compete with other styles of music.
Like gospel, that were spread rapidly and became very popular quickly, began to sort of crowd out the popularity of singing shape note music.
But you better have Jesus. I tell you, I thought.
And it was just about dying off in the 1960s. And a lot of the families who had been traditional Southern singers for many generations really didn't think there'd be any way to keep it going.
Shape Note has been resilient throughout the years. It started hundreds of years ago, battled some heavy competition, and through it all, it's managed to stay alive. But what's critical for it to stay alive now is to appeal to a younger generation.
As the world's evolved, the Shape Note community has evolved along with it. There are Shape Note groups on Facebook, and you can follow Shape Note Scotland on Twitter. You can even listen to Shape Note recordings on SoundCloud. And things like Meetup are getting singers together to continue the tradition.
But Anne says there's a critical mass of younger people that need to attend to sing.
Because if just one young person shows up at a singing, and they look around and they see that everybody looks older than their parents, they're not likely to come back.
And trying to fill those younger slots is necessary.
It's important for us to keep reaching out to groups of young people however we can.
And, well, it's working.
I think it's really exciting to see more young people sing.
That's Robert. He's a part of that younger generation. He's 23.
That's been a challenge for Sacred Harp over its whole history, is trying to convince the young people that this is important.
He's helping bring new people, both old and young, into Shape Note by hosting classes.
Yeah, I'm really excited that everybody's here. And this is kind of the first, what they call a singing school, that I've ever led. So I want to make sure that it's really participatory. If you have anything to add, please just go for it. Feel empowered to do that. So
a lot of people who have been coming to the new singer singings maybe sung in high school in a chorus or in college, and have really missed making music with other people. And I've been lucky enough to continually find different outlets for my need to sing. So I'm really excited that we've created a space that young people feel excited to come to and feel like they're improving their skills and making connections with other people.
It's a little intimidating. So let's just get a little comfortable with the shapes. We can sing a scale and then start jumping around a little bit. So start fa, la, yeah. So fa, sol, la.
I think that there are so many people in the United States that either sang in the past and don't have an outlet for singing anymore, or as a young person, they were told, like, oh, you're not that great of a singer, maybe you should try something else. And that doesn't exist other places. In other places, singing and making music is for everyone. It is something that people can come together over, something that provides really human connections with other people, and that activity is really important.
Robert says he's seen the number of younger people going to the Shape Note Sings increase over the past few years, and those new singer singings are only part of the reason. There's a community that comes along with Shape Note, and he thinks that community is something that people are looking for.
I think there are a lot of young people who find Shape Note music and just get totally hooked because you're singing and creating something with other people that, and you don't get a lot of chance to do that in contemporary life. And that's really beautiful. And I think the young, you know, the generation that is kind of my age in their early to late 20s recognize how great of a thing it is and are taking a more active role in organizing singings, not only in Chicago, but in Boston and Philadelphia and California, all over the place.
At this point, the Shape Note tradition has been around for more than 200 years. And we asked Robert to tell the absolute truth. There's no doubt it's a constant battle to get more people interested, and there's no telling what'll happen in the future. So even though Shape Note seems to be resilient, does he think that it'll outlive him?
There is so much momentum to grow the community of Sacred Harp singers, but it's also really great because even in the growth efforts, there's such a commitment to honoring the past and honoring the people who have been perpetuating this music for so long. There was, I think the publisher of one of the editions of the Sacred Harp once said, and this is in like the late 1800s, he once said that if Sacred Harp lasted until 1950, it would be a miracle. And that's how worried people were that the young people weren't gonna be interested in this. So I have no doubt that it will survive that long at this point.
Thanks to the Chicago Shape Note singers for letting us record their sings, Kate Lumpkin for her vocal stylings, and to Ruth Reveal for pitching today's episode. You can learn more about Shape Note, the Chicago singers, and also read Ruth's paper on Shape Note singing at our website, everythingsounds.org.
And if you'd like to go to a Sacred Harp Shape Note singing yourself, head to fasola.org, and there you can find local Shape Note communities.
That link is on our website as well.
Also on the site, links to our various social media pages on Facebook, SoundCloud, and we tweet at EvSounds. Connect with us and join in on the conversation. Until next time, thanks for listening to Everything Sounds. I'm Craig Shank.
And I'm George Drake Jr.
You're listening to The Spot on KALW. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. While Shape Note singers focus on preserving how to sing, some of us are dealing with how to preserve songs and sounds that have already come and gone.
Ashley, sing.
That's my sister and I. I'm 3 years old, and this is a tape I found during a recent move. Though I don't have a memory of recording this tape or the events that surrounded it, I do have the memory of possessing this tape. With its beige plastic shell and orange and yellow piping around its label. My mom remembers this tape too, and every Christmas she's bugged me to make her a CD copy of it, the only format she can play at home. I always dodged her hints because I thought I lost it. She always seems so excited every year when I'd nod and say, "Yep, Mom, I'm working on it." And more so, I didn't want to believe that I actually lost something that was so precious to her. And to me, too. Independent radio producer Afi Scruggs is in a similar conundrum. Though she has her audio in her possession, whether or not it's safe against the hands of time is another story.
I'm taping you so that I can...
Now, what is this, the primitive version?
Yeah.
Every time a format changes, some crucial information is lost. That's why I made a digital version of an interview I taped with my grandmother back in 1990. I captured the conversation on a cassette tape. It was easy then. Now that tape is a relic. When my tape player dies, my grandmother's words could be gone. Her days are numbered. She's 94 now. So I'm thinking transference and preservation.
They would sing it. They would begin it like this. Jesus, my King, I long to find.
I'd ask about long meter singing, the songs we call Dr. Watts hymns. A leader would call or line the verse, and the congregation would answer by repeating it in long, meandering phrases.
Now the missionary Baptist would sing it this way. Jesus, my King, I long to find. Pray tell me where he dwells.
I'd grown up hearing the songs, but I never learned to sing them. That crucial information had been lost. When I sat down with my grandmother on July 4th, 1990, I was archiving data as surely as I am now.
than the primitive Baptist.
Now, how did you know this? How did you hear these?
I heard these songs. My father.
Her memories have opened the door to another generation. I was enthralled then and now. But now, I compare the voices from the past with those of the present. Now her voice is soft, almost a whisper, when she talks at all. The sound of her brother's voice is precious. He died in
1995.
My tape is digitized in minutes. But before I click the mouse, I whisper my hope in a prayer. May this transfer be successful. May this story be saved and given to another generation.
No matter what, physical audio formats break down. CDs, cassette tapes, vinyl records, none of them are permanent. And sure, digital files make it possible for sounds to carry on even further, but there are still some songs and sounds that were abandoned before they could make it to the next format change. And what about the sounds that never made it to a recording device at all? From the podcast, The Memory Palace, here's Nate DeMayo.
In 1994, maybe it was 95, I was in a band, and it wasn't very good. And that was largely my fault. And we were playing a show in a living room in Santa Cruz, California. It was all very punk rock. And the first band was playing while I paced around in the hallway, nervous, because I knew my mediocre drumming was what kept us from being a good band. And the opening act playing in the living room were two women, and a guitar and a snare. It was all very punk rock. And while I was out there in the hallway, they played a song that just killed me. It was simple and confessional, and their voices were lovely. I bought a tape from them afterward. And a few days later, the tape deck in my car ate it, the way that tape decks in your car used to do. And I lost the song. And I looked for it for years, in every record store. And I never found it. And then I forgot about it. But the other day, I was tooling around on my computer, and I Googled it. And there it was. The same exact version, uploaded from the cassette. It took all of a minute and a half. And then I was, for a moment, in the living room on Galt Street. And I could see the punk rock kids sitting on the floor like it was story time at the library. I could see the friends I had wished I'd kept in touch with, and the ones I was better off without. All because of the sound of a snare and a guitar, and the voices of two 19-year-old girls. Now, I know this is a whole lot of preamble, but there's a point, and it's a simple one, but it is one that kills me. Before the advent of recorded sound, you heard something once, and that was it. You heard a song. Maybe you could buy the sheet music. Maybe you could pick out the tune on your banjo or the piano in your parlor, and maybe you could conjure up some sort of approximation. But you heard something once, and that was it. There are no existing recordings of Jenny Lind. She died in 1887, at 67 years old, just after the first recording devices were invented. There's some evidence that she sang for Edison in his studio right before her death, but the recording is lost if she did. And it does seem that we're missing out. People who know these things tell us that Jenny Lind was the greatest singer of the 19th century, the greatest white singer in the white Western canon. People said she sounded like an angel, or silver, or spun silk, or like a bird perched high in a thin branch, or a nightingale. People today, historians, opera buffs, whomever, sometimes call her the first rock star, but I won't. A rock star is someone you can hold in your hands, and lie on the floor with when you put on your stereo with your headphones on. Someone you can watch over and over on Ed Sullivan or MTV or on YouTube or Vimeo. Jenny Lind wasn't a rock star. She was a firefly. She would flicker for a moment and then vanish and be gone. And such was the desire to see her glow that she sold out concerts at the biggest opera houses night after night for months on end. Year after year, And in 1849, this success caught the eye of a man who said he had no ear for music. P.T. Barnum came to London and made Jenny Lind an offer. He would pay her $170,000 if she would come to America and perform 170 shows. And that was a fortune at the time. He had never actually heard her sing. He didn't care, because he knew she could sell tickets. Jenny Lind arrived in New York on the 1st of September the following year. 40,000 people lined the docks to greet a singer they had never heard sing. Tickets to her first set of American concerts were sold by auction. The cheapest seats went for about $250, meaning that it cost roughly the average middle-class income in America at that time just to get in the building. But the wealthy of the New World happily shelled out for the chance to hear, just once, the reigning voice of the Old World. And in lieu of a CD or a box set or a download or an uploaded cell phone video or a cassette sold out of the back of a car after a show, they bought tchotchkes, Jenny Lind curios, Jenny Lind waistcoat buttons, Jenny Lind porcelain dolls, handkerchiefs, gravy boats, anything that could remind them of what they heard once. And the people outside the theaters, the people who couldn't afford to get in, were swept up too. P.T. Barnum made sure of that. He played the press, feeding them true stories of Lind's charity and chastity and religious piety. And America loved their superstars chaste and pious. Even then. On a warm winter's night in 1851, a few hundred people crowded into a Methodist church that sat high on a hill above the river in Natchez, Mississippi. The town's few wealthy citizens, the plantation owners, sat in the pews, dressed up for a night at the opera, which was a type of night that most of them had never had before, and that none of them could have ever expected to have right there in the Delta. And in the last rows, and standing in the back, and squeezed onto benches up in the rafters, were the shop owners, and the men who ran the docks, and the women who hung linen, many of them European immigrants whose lives had somehow led them here to the middle of nowhere, far from home, and the music and the sounds they'd left behind. And for an hour, once, Jenny Lind, accompanied by a single piano, because there was nowhere for the orchestra to sit inside the small church, sang songs some of them hadn't heard since they'd left home, and others had never heard before, and that all of them would likely never hear again. Jenny Lind sang, and then she was gone.
You can hear that story more than once if you'd like at thememorypalace.org. Like Jenny Lind's voice, radio can seem ethereal too. It's let out onto the airwaves, sometimes never recorded, and never to be heard again. But since we now live in a world where just about everything lives on the internet for seemingly forever, you can find this episode and more from The Spot at kalw.org. And if you've got a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next week for a whole new episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.